two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, are you ready to add a sprinkle of joy to your day? Then you need to check out Add to Cart. Hi, I'm Sujan Pak.
And I'm Kulap Vilaysack. We're your hosts, and on this show, we talk about the things we buy, the things we buy into, and what it says about who we are.
That's right. Each week, we're going to have some honest and maybe, you know, a little TMI conversations about all the fabulous, weird, wonderful things we're adding to or ditching from our carts. You know, we talk about beauty products, latest health trends, philosophies we're passionate about. Nothing is off limits on this podcast.
We're diving deep into everything we and our guests buy into and exploring what it reveals about who we truly are. We're going to decide what's worth the investment, be it money or emotions.
Add to Cart from Lemonada Media has new episodes out on Tuesdays, wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
How did I get hired at my first restaurant job? That's a bizarre question, but I would love to tell you. I was 17 years old when I found a listing on Craigslist for open interviews. I had never heard that term before, but I had watched enough America's Next Top Model to know what an open casting call was. So I figured open interviews would probably work the same, just with like less modeling, I'm assuming. I immediately got dressed in the fanciest outfit I could find in my closet, which I think ended up being some type of like Forever 21 blazer and some jeans that had so many holes in them on purpose. They were basically shorts. It felt right, I guess. I rode the city bus from La Palma to Huntington Beach, California, where eventually I would actually move to, but that's a different story for a different day. And I walked through an industrial business park to find the sign I was looking for. Quote, open interviews, new restaurant, opening soon. This was me. I had 100% confidence in the tank and 0% reason for it, because up until this point, I have never served a day in my life. There's a funny hierarchy that happens in restaurants, and if you've not worked in one, you wouldn't really know, but the staff has ranked each position at a restaurant they work at with a specific level of importance, and you don't jump ranks too soon. You don't really jump ranks at all. You slowly, painfully crawl your way up the ranks with the permission of like 12 people you didn't even know existed until it comes time for you to climb those ranks. What are ranks? Doesn't even feel like a real word anymore. Any hoops? The fact that this was a new restaurant under construction means that the owners and the head chef were going to have to train the entire staff on the menu and also the culture of the restaurant that doesn't exist yet. So sure, being a seasoned server would probably come in handy, but beyond knowing how to hold a couple more plates than everybody else, I mean, even the people with no experience, me, could probably keep up. Eventually, yes, but right away, no. Turns out they were group interviews. You'd think that would be less intimidating because there's more people to focus on at once, but then you all end up just interviewing each other and it becomes kind of like the Hunger Games of interviews, which ends up being even worse than a one-on-one interview. I was very upfront with the fact that I knew absolutely nothing about being a server in a restaurant, and I don't really know if divulging that much information that quickly was as necessary as I initially thought it would be. Things were not going incredibly well. I didn't know how to speak in a group like this, and I figured I was out of the running pretty much immediately. Mainly because one of the first things I blurted out when I sat down was, I don't have any serving experience. No serving experience here. No clue what I'm doing. Would love to learn? Don't know. Fast learner? Don't know what I'm doing. About middle of the way through the interview, one of the owners saw me in the back being way more quiet than I was at the start of the interview. I was intentionally pulling away. I wanted this job so badly and I knew I wasn't going to get it. So I decided I don't want to want this job. But she wanted me to engage. So she started giving me a preview of the menu to see how I would react. She started calling off a few of their main entrees, one being spaghetti and gigantic meatball. My face lit up immediately, because this is exactly how my grandmother makes spaghetti, with just one big meatball plopped on top. And I raised my hand without even thinking, and I said, "I love spaghetti and meatball," emphasis on the singular. I shared my personal connection to the recipe and how shocked I was because I'd never seen anybody else make spaghetti like this, and I was back in the running. But then next was a role-playing exercise where we had to pretend to serve the owners of the restaurant at a fake table, and I was back out of the running. I flipped back and forth many times during this interview, and at the end of it, I really wasn't sure where I stood. Mostly, though, my confusion was attributed to the fact that this was the most bizarre and most extensive interview I have ever had and ever will be a part of in my entire life. You would have thought we were auditioning for a role in a Broadway musical where the majority of the plot happens in a restaurant. There was so much detail and so many games. I waited a week or so, and then I finally got the call that I did receive the job, but I'm 100% positive it was only because I got so excited about a giant meatball. Thank you. Okay, actually, can you just pretend that you're listening to a fully complete theme song here? I got really in my head, and I tried to make it perfect, and I couldn't. So this is going to be the theme song right here. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Funny 'Cause It's True. I'm Elise Myers. Today, I'm talking to comedian and actor Moses Storm. I've been following Moses' work for quite a while now, and his comedy is so perfectly tailored to what my brain thinks is funny that I just quickly became obsessed with like every piece of content that he puts out. And his life is kind of incredible. Well, not even kind of. His life story is very incredible. Moses was raised in this tiny cult with no formal education until college. And then as a kid, he would find joy by watching Conan O'Brien in secret. And then now as an adult, all these years later, Conan O'Brien is producing his work. How does that even happen? This interview with Moses is easily one of my favorites because it's all about the power of comedy. So two things that are funny because they're true. Number one, Moses and I are both dyslexic. And I just think that's a really fun fact. We talk a little bit about it in the interview, and it actually plays a part in how he named his special Trash White. And that brings me to my second point. When I was watching his special Trash White, I had to pause the TV multiple times because I was laughing so hard I kept missing like the jokes that followed my laughter, and I didn't want to miss anything. So I kept pausing and laughing. And then I would play his special in my car as I would drive to work because it's so good I wanted to hear it 17,000 times. So definitely go watch it. Okay, let's get into it. Moses, hello.
Hello.
I'm grateful that, you know, you are able to join me today. Listen, I know we just started, but before we get into anything of actual substance, I need you to know what got cut out here. So I was really nervous to talk to Moses, and literally one of the first things that pops out of my mouth as soon as his face loads up in my computer screen was to compliment him on his special. But the way I did it was by basically shouting at him, "Your special is so f***ing good." That was how I greeted him. Oh my God, Elise. I wanted to start with a little icebreaker really quick. If we were to start a TikTok trend, like what would that trend be?
Oh man. This might be too inside baseball. I can't believe I had an answer to this. But there's a really bad trend that's happening where everyone's constantly uploading comedian crowd work clips. I'm sure you've come across one.
Oh, yeah. It's like my whole For You page right now.
Right. You watch one and it's really the HPV of videos. It just keeps going back. And the thing with crowd work is it's not that good. It's a lot of you had to be there moments. If you were in that room and you were drinking and you were in Atlanta at 11 p.m., I'm sure it's pretty hilarious that that guy was wearing a Hawaiian shirt and his name was Greg. What? It's a big laugh in the room, but it does not translate So my trend would be, because all those videos with very lame roasts and they have the most aggressive titles where it's like, comedian owns heckler.
Yeah.
Comedian
slams.
Epically shuts down pro-lifer. And, it's like, and then you watch the video and it's like, duh, you, no, you shut up. What's your name, Tony? So then the trend would be audience members epically owning comedians. So this is a nightmare of mine, but people would go to a show and they would film themselves like the comedians film themselves, and they would just give a mild, gentle comeback of like, yeah, my name is Tony, but it's actually Anthony because from my Italian heritage, and then you can make fun of that. And then they can upload as a clapback. Audience member epically owns comedian.
I've seen a lot of videos where some people say that like stand-up is going to die in the next few years because of the rise of people uploading heckling clips. People that have never been to a stand-up show are now only seeing their first time with stand-up through the view of somebody heckling. So they their first introduction to this is a two-way conversation because people don't want to burn their content, like Jack, like you said. And I'm curious, like, because you do have interactive elements to your comedy, do you feel like that helps people feel like they can be involved? And then also when it's not their turn to participate, that they can just sit back and listen?
The new show I'm working on is even more audience participation. So rather than fight it, I see the same thing that you see. It's like, yeah, it is going to change comedy because that is most people's experience with it. More people are watching that one heckler clip than will ever watch your HBO special.
Yeah.
So rather than try to fight that, I'm just leaning into that.
I like that.
So with the new show, The Perfect Cult, basically the rough concept of the show is that we're making my cult didn't work out, my family's cult. So we're trying to make the perfect cult with the audience that night, based on everyone's experience in that room with religion and some of my own. And I share a little bit of me, like, here's where I think maybe things went wrong. And here's what we need, members, that's you guys. So just try to fold them in.
And I guess for people that don't know, because you just mentioned the experience in the cult, like, can you share a little bit about kind of what your childhood was like?
Yeah, I think it's a little generous to say that I was raised in a cult. Because I was raised in a profoundly unsuccessful doomsday cult.
When you say unsuccessful, what does that mean?
I guess I'm marking success in that we couldn't get our own Netflix special today.
Okay.
it's not really the merits of a religion that makes someone's life better or even makes some money. Was there enough murder? Was there enough intrigue and sex parties in the common room to get your own special? And no.
Okay.
It was my parents and the two other families, and it was a failure from beginning to end. It was a mixture of Judaism and Catholicism. It had no name.
No name.
Yeah, no name. That's something you should try on TikTok.
I think that's where they went wrong.
How do we follow you?
You don't.
Like, what?
I know that your HBO special talks a little bit about it. For you, kind of what does that process look like of trying to figure out what to include from your childhood and what not to? Like having the balance of serious versus funny, and how do you find that balance?
Yes. I guess the job of a comedian is to not bum people out.
Right.
We've all had trauma in our own lives. We've all had things that happened to us. And it's beautiful to talk about those on stage. But if you are doing stand-up, you do have to dig people out of that hole.
Right.
The tired nurse just got off her 16-hour shift and is putting on stand-up to forget about her life.
Yeah. This reminds me so much of when Atsuko was talking about how comedy is a service and how you have to like people to be good at comedy. It's like the comedian is the center of attention, but they're also catering to what other people need and want to see. I just think it's so cool. Is that kind of what got you into performing? Is that you wanted to kind of just be a pause in someone's day? Like, what got you into that?
Oh, yeah. It's something I wanted to give back because I feel less guilty about how much joy I got from it. Wow. Which is, if you weren't convinced I was raised in a cult, that there it is. feeling guilt around just joy.
Guilt, shame. Yeah. Enjoying your life.
I feel good. I'm guilty. I'm very guilty about that.
I feel guilty all the time. It's amazing.
Yeah. I think it was such an escape for us because there were so many moments that were just hell. And if I saw a comedy, if I saw a Chris Farley movie, or if I watched Conan growing up secretly, these are things that brought me so much joy that, I don't know. I was like, it's so fun. And it made me feel so good. I should do that.
Yeah.
So that was it. That was as much thought went into it. And then I was also 18 and I had never been to school and could barely read or write. So I was like, okay, well, probably comedy. That's probably the one thing I could maybe monetize and break generational poverty.
What was your entry into the like comedy performing world, if that's kind of how you started?
So I think first I started working at a grocery store. A cult leader came back into our life and completely gaslit my mom. It was like, what are you doing? Gosh. You got to get a job. Your kids have to get a job. And I was 16. I got a job at a grocery store. And then that's where I started for the first time being around kids my age or just people my age.
Yeah.
And without the supervision of my parents. Because the other thing about not being in school, traveling around in a bus, spreading the word, and always moving is that that's the most isolating thing. Travel is very isolating. And then I fell in love with the girl at the grocery store, or at least what I thought love was at 16. And everything about the cult said that that was wrong and that this girl was going to hell and I would go to hell if we were ever together. And then it was just a feeling thing. It was knowing how I felt. That's a true feeling. Okay. Well, then this other cult stuff is probably bullshit then, because this feels real.
So it was the girl.
Yeah.
Did you guys end up dating?
Yeah, briefly. And then it was like, oh, it was just a kind person. But it's really what you're doing to me right now. At least it's just someone that's kind and intelligent that I'm able to say things out loud to. And then when it's absorbed in your ears and then you just see how you process it and just be, oh, fuck. Just a sweet, kind person saying like, hey, that's maybe not the truth. Maybe this isn't all going to burn.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sure too, like, because you were so isolated, you didn't have a lot of people that allowed you to ask questions or have any room in your life where you could even ask a question, right? And I feel like somebody else seeing your life from the outside, even asking you like, so you live in a van or like, so you didn't go to school, you know, just having somebody outside asking you those, you probably didn't realize it was weird or not, you know, the normal experience until you're talking to someone who had a very classic experience as a child, which would have just been really disorienting, I feel like.
Exactly. I mean, it was exactly that. We weren't allowed to ask questions because that was seen as doubting or not having faith. So not only were you not allowed, but it was like a high crime. So just the first time that I was able to do that, I mean, I felt like a bad boy. I felt like, what a rebel right now. I'm just asking questions, having some free thought over here.
Holy shit. Pass
that free thought.
We got to take a quick break, but when we return, Moses tells us about his time in college.
You've likely encountered countless astrology stereotypes or hundreds of astrology memes saturating social media, but have you ever pondered what's beyond the surface? There's a new podcast we want to recommend called Stars and Stars with Issa. In each episode, astrologer Issa Nakazawa sits down with the biggest stars of our time, uncovering surprising insights hidden within their birth charts while shedding light on their life paths and purposes. Hear what the stars and cosmos have to say about guests like W. Kamau Bell, Aja Monet, Gia Tolentino, Umi, and more. You'll laugh, cry, and come away with insights about your own life you never imagined. Listen to Stars and Stars with Issa wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few, and of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
So from the grocery store, how did comedy and acting happen?
So the grocery store gave me a little bit of separation. I was able to steal a little bit of my paycheck back instead of just giving it to my mom and like make a little nest egg. And I signed myself up for a college. It's the desert of California, so anyone could go. You didn't need a GED.
So when you said you didn't go to school, when was the cutoff for you? Like, did you stop going in high school or middle school?
Never.
Never. Got it.
If God's going to end the world, according to my parents, in like 46 minutes from right now, there's really no reason to go to school. There's no reason to get a job or lay any roots or future plan, because we were always made to feel like fire and brimstone and this was all going to collapse.
Wow.
Yeah. So Antelope Valley Community College, and I don't know if it was a college or just a bus stop was close and then adults learned there. It wasn't.
Both equally as helpful.
It wasn't maybe the brightest of people. One time I was in a Final Cut, like video editing class, and I look over and there's a 65-year-old guy. He's eating an orange, like an apple with the peel on it. And I just, you see the blue light coming from his face and all the zest shoot out onto the screen. And it's not even like he's enjoying it. Like, oh, it's his preference. He likes it. He's wincing. He's like, ooh, this is zesty.
He's like, I hate oranges. I eat them every day at 1 o'clock. Like,
what? He's physically in pain eating this orange. Like, ooh, he's wincing with every peel bite. But there was enough people making videos there that were making like funny videos, and from what I had secretly watched behind my mom's back of Conan, they were making sketches at the same time that YouTube was a thing. So it was just like, Oh, being able to make videos with people that I met at that terrible college, my friends, and by my friends there, just like, oh, the one people that were not 1,000 years old or had bags for shoes or
eating oranges like apples.
Exactly. So she's like, oh, yeah. Kids my age. So we started making videos, and then two of us moved down to LA because it was a two-hour drive.
So you guys were like making videos, and You mentioned Conan twice. So I feel like he's a big part of your story. Did you end up ever like working with him, or was it just his comedic influence?
My brother started secretly watching that show for the musical performances. They're very talented musicians and can play anything that they pick up. So I saw the show, the comedy, for the first time. I had never seen anything like it. And I went so far as convincing my mom, because we were very anti-school, to sign me up for this video program called Abeka Academy. It's a Christian video academy where they send you VHS tapes of kids in a classroom actively going through puberty and trying to pass around the most sensitive microphone in the world. And you are like, the teacher pauses, like, oh, and then for our video students at home, what do you think the answer is for A? And I was too far gone at that point. I could barely read or write to really keep up with any of those classes. I tried. But the whole point was to get my own TV VCR in my room so that I could secretly record Conan. That was really the main reason.
You set out to do that. Yes. That was your intention. Yeah. That's genius. You should be very proud of this plan.
What a psycho. This is like a villain's origin story where you just see them. Because I would put the tape in and he would come on at 1. I mean, it was like 12:30. I have to stay up, put the tape in, press record, and then turn the TV off again. And then start up record. And then back in the morning when it was like I was supposed to be doing school, then I could watch it back. But then just be up the whole time with my heart racing.
Did anyone ever find out?
Oh, yeah. My brothers definitely found out. I told them what I told you, thinking I was like, you know, you didn't know what I was doing in that room. One, they thought I was just masturbating. They just thought, like, every boy. I was just under a series of blankets with a TV and VCR around me, just so hot. Just a hot 90s TV.
Sweating. With like the static too, like when you put blankets over them, the static got worse. And so like anytime you moved, your hair just like shocked you.
Okay, so they probably don't even believe me today.
They probably don't.
Sure. So that show was such a huge influence. And maybe for the first, who you are on stage, as a person, I was ripping off Conan's identity. Like people would say that. Because I picked up on all the mannerisms.
You're just like, thank you.
Right. Oh, I'll have to check that out. What is that? Sounds like it's of the devil, but okay, thank you.
Why was it Conan? Like, what about him made you react like that?
Because on its surface, if you were just to watch it, like, this is the dumbest comedy in the world.
Okay.
But then when you keep watching, you understand that this is someone that puts a lot of heart and attention and work. Something as stupid as like the characters they would bring on, like FedEx Pope. If you just think about like cutting a FedEx box, making it a Pope hat, And you felt like, oh shit, I have this connection with you because that's what I want to do. Put a shit ton of work behind something so stupid. So then we make bad videos. I have 4 jobs, work at this after hours nightclub as a busboy, meaning that people just throw up on the ground and I pour sawdust over it and I sweep it up. Oh, like, I'm not really busting tables. People aren't ordering a chicken linguine. People are eating handfuls of ecstasy and throwing up on the carpet.
You're like busing human beings. You're the vomit busser.
So I started doing stand-up from there because friends told me to. Like, you should do stand-up. And then I did The Coward's Way Out, and I did improv intently.
This is fascinating to me because when I was talking to other comedians, that sounds like I'm like telling on Moses. Oh, yeah? Well, I was talking to other comedians. Okay, sorry. Focus. Okay. So when I was talking to comedians like Angela Kinsey and Mike Birbiglia and others whose background is so like rich in improv, they would say that improv was like one of the hardest things you can do. And so it's really like it blows my mind every time I get to talk to these professional comedians who are so good at what they do, who have vastly different opinions about what like is hard and what is good. It's just, I think it's all difficult. So there's that. Is that The Coward's Way Out?
It's like a little bit easier because you fail together and it's way more fun. If I could survive on improv alone, oh boy, would I love that. It's not cowardly totally, but if you are afraid to get on stage, that's a great first step. That's a great thing because you're with other people. You don't have to be funny. The other person could be the funny person. You could be the straight man. And you can still feel what it feels like to get a laugh.
Yeah.
To hear yourself pace and talk on stage, get comfortable. Where do you put your hands?
Oh, yeah.
So it is a great thing. You just can't fall into the trap where that's all you do.
Right.
You have to have something else. Like you like making videos and something that's tangible and not just for that 100 people that night that you perform for.
Okay, so you started with improv, but what did you do after that?
Then the finally worked up the courage to stand up. I had lied to a woman that was running this showcase at the Hollywood Improv, and it was a sold out night. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. I have 5 minutes. I could do that. I did a 5-minute set, and then something right away happened somewhere. I got heckled or someone started talking back. And I immediately started just addressing that because I, as myself, and had dropped the jokes I had started with or had written down 2 years before. It was when I was too nervous to get on stage. And it was the first time in my life that I was able to pause and listen to who I was. Everything has been trying to please this religion or then getting out of the religion and just trying to keep up, trying to blend in with other people. Like, I just want to fit in. I know I'm very weird and I come from this insane past. I'm really ashamed of all this stuff. And there's just so much mental noise and self-judgment and self-hate in that. And being on stage, when it was the whole room laughing and it was everything else was silenced in my head. And I was like, I need all that noise for it to feel silent. And it felt great. And I was like, oh, I just want to do this. Whatever I have to do to feel this feeling again and do this, that's what I'm going to do. In that moment where you get a laugh, it feels like an eternity. But yeah, so probably 2 seconds. And then it went well and I booked a bunch of shows. From there, I got my agent manager at that one show.
That's amazing.
Yeah, like, kid, who are you going to be a star? a terrible movie.
We have to take one more break. When we come back, we hear how Moses met and started writing for Conan O'Brien himself.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive. From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
So then started doing stand-up, and then I started my own show, because you got to go back to, you got to make your own things. No one's going to give you a job. No one's going to give you stage time as a performer. Yeah. And I would book comedians that I admired.
What was the show called again?
This Show Is Your Show.
That's what it's called? This Show Is Your Show?
Yeah. Well, very confusing name. People always got it wrong. You think Trash White's hard? Like, are you still doing Show Your Show? What is that? Show Your Show? So then the Conan producers saw myself and my new co-host, Chris Redd. So him and I were just co-hosting, and we do joint stand-up. So then that show started going really well, and then I got into the festival Just for Laughs, which is a big comedy showcase in Montreal, where everyone that works at Netflix, HBO, all the networks, they all go up there and they watch your, you know, five-minute showcase, essentially. And it's a whole industry party.
Was that terrifying for you, or were you hyped about that?
Yeah, I was pretty terrified. I think I threw up on the street running there.
Was there anyone with sawdust to pick it up for you, or did you have to do that yourself?
Yeah, no, I always have the sawdust on me.
Just pockets of sawdust everywhere.
Exactly. It was the fastest throw up. I can't think, because I didn't take time. I was on the street. I was running to the venue. I was so nervous. I was like, bah! And then it came out clean.
Well, I feel better.
It was like a SpongeBob throw up. It was like, bah! And then completely clean, walked away. Didn't have to wipe the mouth.
Oh, my gosh.
From there, JP, who was the booker, he said, you should do Conan sometime. And I was like, yeah, I should. Dude, you're the guy. I should do that.
That's like...
He's like, I'll start working on a set for the show.
That's like all of your dreams just coming to life. And then you ended up working on the show after that.
Yeah. So, and then Chris and I get hired to do Conan O'Brien's pre-show. So before Conan would do his shows down at Comic-Con, at the Spreckles Theater, he was going to be a pre-show. And it would be two comedians up on the roof of the theater, just kind of throwing to clips, sort of like a MTV Spring Break style thing. And then the first one, they were supposed to get Conan O'Brien to come up on the roof with Chris and I, which, like, holy shit. This is the first time we met him.
Oh my gosh.
So we get up on this beach set roof that they built on top of this theater, and it's San Diego in late summer. So it's hot as shit. The makeup they put on is melting off. The beach, the beach ball that's like made for the beach heat is melting. Like the air's different. The pH level's different. There's a vent that lets out tapas air.
Hot exhaust.
Just hot exhaust from this tapas restaurant. So just hot tapas air is coming up. I had this beach set that looks on fire.
Just sweaty tacos and like small plates. You're like, I smell like aioli fries.
Absolutely.
I love this.
Hell up there. But Chris and I, we did complain, and we were just like riffing on that stuff. Conan comes up. What was supposed to be a 30-second thing, just 20 minutes of just bullshitting with us to the point where his producers have to come and physically pull him down. And this is the first week of shows. So then the next show he comes up, he does the same thing. And now we do 30 minutes. It's a bigger part of the show. And he's just riffing with us. I can't hear my own voice. It's like your hero is just like in your ear. And you're just trying to keep up as fast as you can. And I keep pitching things to tell tell Conan, but I keep running him by Chris first as my friend. Like, is it in psycho if I say this? Like, I secretly record. He's like, yeah, maybe just hold off a little bit.
Your ears are just like ringing. Everything is just like tunnel vision. Yeah. You're like, Conan, it's the only thing that matters.
Yeah, it's the only thing that matters. And he's telling me, like a good friend, like, oh, don't do that. That's psycho. You're gonna scare that girl away.
We need friends like that in our life, honestly.
Yeah. But then I end up telling Conan the story that I told you about how I would secretly record the show. And then we got to talking And then I can't remember how we got to this point, but he asked Chris and I both what we wanted to do. And I was like, I want to do stand-up, and I also want to act. He said, okay, we can make that happen. And then Conan is the one that produced Trash White and told HBO that I was a comedian and that they should trust me. And they wanted a relationship with him. They had no idea who I was young, unproven, nothing to show for it. But it was just Conan having my back. And then, yeah, and then it went well. And then I put a shit ton of work because it was my shot. So
yeah,
put everything into it.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, to be able to do that for someone, I mean, that is my greatest dream. People are like, what do you want to do? What movie do you see yourself in? If I could do that for someone, that, yeah.
I love that you're doing so much with it. Like, you are so good at what you do. And I know that you appreciate it so much, which makes all the difference. And so it's called, I keep wanting to call it White Trash, and it's not that. It's Trash White.
Yeah.
Right. Got it. I'm dyslexic as well. So every time I've been flipping it this whole time.
Well, me too, because I would always do that with White Trash, because I'm dyslexic. So I would...
Really? Is that why you called it Trash White?
Yeah. And then every set piece on that set that I built, there's things from the stories in each thing. So all those items are pointed things. And if you could make a monochromatic piece of art out of all the shit that happened to you in your life and all the stuff that is trash.
Oh my gosh. Now I want to go back and watch it again with that perspective. I feel like I missed that somewhere. I should have known that.
Oh yeah. There's things from every story in that pile.
That's so powerful. Okay, wait. Now I have a question about that. What does that feel like performing on a stage like that with art that has been made out of things that probably felt really shitty from your life, but you've made it beautiful? What does that feel like?
It felt great. It felt incredible. Yeah, there was no attachment to any of the things in there, because some of the things are real things from my life and from those stories.
Yeah.
But the nerves were significantly curbed the night of the taping.
Because of the set and how
Because I had spent so much time in that building. Usually you show up to the venue, maybe at 5 p.m., the show's at 7, and you're like, oh, shit, this looks incredible. And it's a little intimidating to see all those lights for the first time and see the 1,200-person audience that we had, to see like all those empty chairs. But I was in there the entire night. I stayed up again the night before.
training your whole life for this.
Yeah. I'd been working on this for months, building the set off-site, brought it in, had to tie all those pieces together, follow the safety codes. So I was there when they were placing all the lights. So I got to see this whole thing get built around me. So by the time it was the show, I was inviting them into my thing that I made, my exhibit that I made.
It's like your home.
Yeah. So it's like, well, thank you for coming to my thing versus like, oh God, I'm stepping on the stage. What if everyone hates me there? It's like, you're going to hate me there. This is my thing.
You're coming into my house, yeah. Sir. So you can just sit on my couch.
So I inadvertently made it like significantly easier. Even though while the audience was being sat, I was still hand painting things. And in the first taping, there you could see physically white paint on my hands. I was still up until the second that they said go.
Okay, coming in hot with a fun fact. So Moses did this super immersive exhibit in 2014 called Modern Millennial, where he basically crowdfunded enough money to get a loft and then invited people to come and watch him like live his life 24/7. He has always been inviting audiences into very intimate parts of his life. There's so much power behind being comfortable in a space that you're going to be creatively performing, especially for strangers. And for you specifically, I just don't get the feeling that you had a lot of consistency growing up and being able to have control over this creative thing you're doing and feeling so safe in it. That's a very powerful thing, I think, especially for you and what you're performing. And so I just love that for you.
Yeah. It's a hard thing to recommend to other comedians. It's like, you should build your own set. Don't work on your jokes.
You should be hand painting things right before you people come in.
You should direct it. And then you should edit it. You should spend 2 months editing it yourself and then spend the second month regretting that you agreed to edit it.
Dude, it's so good. Trash White genuinely is so good. I want to watch it like 12 more times. I hope you're so proud of it.
Thank you. And it really does. When I say that, I really mean it, because I was there.
Oh,
I was painting those pieces. I was on the road performing in dog shit cities that we will now name. and doing this for people that don't give a shit, that are just there to drink and eat chicken wings. And then just in the edit or fighting with HBO to be like, you have to trust me. You have to let me co-direct this. You have to let me edit this. And there's so many hard days, so many difficult things. So when people say that they like it, it means the world to me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is how I feel about like this podcast, which is funny because everyone listening is like, you're not in dog shit cities. That's not what I mean to everybody listening. I mean, like, I have intentionally inserted myself into creative decisions that I don't know if most like podcast hosts would, simply for time's sake, you know?
Yeah.
And like, it doesn't matter. And like, to me, I just take everything I do very seriously, and I really want everything to feel like me. And so, yeah, there's a lot of work that goes into it. And oftentimes I'm about one decision away from quitting before every single interview. I'm like, you know what? I'm actually okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
But then you hear the product of it, and it's beautiful. Like, do you know what I mean? You hear the thing that you created.
I know 100% what you mean. This is why I was excited to talk to you. I was just watching your work. Was like, oh, shit, yeah, there's someone that works like I work. Like you.
I love that.
That's what I meant when I said that you care.
Moses, seriously, thank you so much for making the time.
No, seriously, thank you so much for having me. And I meant everything I said. It's really impressive, everything you do. So it means a lot to me. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Moses. Thank you. I have nothing to add. Moses' story is so incredible. I don't want to mess it up by trying to summarize it in any way. So thank you for listening. That's it for my conversation with Moses Storm. And definitely go watch his special. If you want, you can rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. No pressure. It just helps people find us. Okay, bye. There's more Funny 'Cause It's True with Lemonada Premium. You'll get access to all of Lemonada's premium content, including My 5 Questions with Moses Storm, coming out this Friday. Subscribe now in Apple Podcasts. Funny 'Cause It's True is a Lemonada Media and Powder Keg production. The show is produced by Claire Jones, Zoe Dennis, Nancy Rosenbaum, and Linnea Tony. Our associate producer is Tiffany Bowie. Rachel Neal is our Senior Director of New Content, and our VP of Weekly Production is Steve Nelson. Executive producers are Stephanie Whittles-Wax, Jessica Cordova-Kramer, Paul Feig, Laura Fisher, Kesla Childers, and me, Elise Myers. This show is mixed by Johnny Vince Evans, additional help from Noah Smith and Ivan Kraev. Our theme song music was written by me and scored by Xander Singh. Follow Funny 'Cause It's True wherever you get your podcasts, or listen ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrush are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, friends, it's Meghan Trainor.
And her big bro, Ryan Trainor.
And her husband, Daryl Sabara.
Each week on our podcast, Working On It, we share behind-the-scenes stories and bring you into our hilarious and heartfelt conversations, and sometimes with amazing guests.
We tackle everything from navigating Hollywood to mental health to Meghan becoming a mother, Daryl becoming a father, and so much more.
We'll get into the nitty-gritty of our lives and leave no detail behind. Prepare to laugh, cry, and hopefully learn something new.
Listen to new episodes out every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.